Let me change that. Microdomains of calcium signals in glial cells. So I'm going to be talking to you about glial cells to begin with, and you've already heard some about astrocytes yesterday from Jim Lechleiter, and you'll hear a lot more this afternoon from Andy when he comes up after lunch. I want to begin by thanking the organizers for inviting me and giving me this forum to present some of this data. Also, as an apology, I should say, some of you have seen much of this data at one time or the other in beginning stages and completed stages, etc. So please bear with me. So glial cells. Glial cells, in fact, take up much of the space in the brain, as you know, although neurons have been given the primary role in signal processing and signal transmission. Glial cells, in fact, play a central role, both in terms of conditioning the environment for neurons to function properly, and in addition, recently we have learned that they carry signals. Oh, the colors are the green cells are all astrocytes, or in this particular case, this is a cerebellar slice. So you're looking at Bergman glial cells here, and the yellow is overlapping with the red, which is IP3 receptor. It happens to be in this case. I just took that as an example. And I put it here also to impress upon you where, in fact, the signal actually happens. This is a hippocampal region where it comes from. I have it in very low magnification, 10x, and then an intermediate magnification, and going on to very fine detail of how the interaction between neuron and glia take place. Again, the color scheme is the same. The green is a cell marker for astrocytes, and the red is IP3R. Now, thank you very much. Thank you very much. So I put it here also. So you see, as I mentioned, much of the space is in fact taken up by, takes a lot of energy, by the green color. When you look at the global picture of the brain, and all of these green dots and green lines that are in there are glial cells and their processes. The red here, this is a pyramidal cell layer, and this astrocyte comes from stratum radiatum, where these arrows are. And so here, if you look at this astrocyte, it has big, large processes which arborize into very fine mesh-like protoplasmic processes which go into the neuropil, and their function, in fact, is to basically cover the synapse. So each of these little dots you see here, which are concentration of IP3 receptors, occur within these glial processes which are covering the synapse, both the presynaptic and postsynaptic membrane, in such a way they provide conditioning environment for synapse to function, as well as they monitor the signaling that is being done in the synapse. So here, one such area I have magnified of this is the cell marker signal, and then you can see these little boutons, as it were, which in fact represent areas of the coverage of the synapse. And these are the IP3 receptor. And here, this overlay shows you that they are co-localized. Now, if one does in the same area distribution of synaptic markers, they do not overlap. They are, in fact, opposing each other as far as that we could resolve them in this light microscopy techniques. So this is to show, now this is again a very low magnification picture of the cortex, just showing you astrocytes that basically wall to wall, that the cells are organized. These black spaces are where the neurons would exist, and the processes here go hundreds of microns. And so if they detect a signal here, they would transmit as calcium waves towards the cell body, as well as between astrocytes, in such a way that a local calcium wave between astrocytes occur. And Andy will talk about that later on during the day today. And I have organized my presentation in such a way that we're going to look at some examples of calcium waves, both in intact tissue as well as in tissue culture preparations, and then the calcium wave amplification sites are the mechanism of calcium propagation within processes, then a characterization, kinetic characterization, using line scan analysis of glial cell processes to look at these microdomains or wave amplification sites in their function, and finally the specializations at the microdomains of calcium release. This in terms of both organelle as well as protein collections that form the microdomains of calcium release. To begin with then, wave propagation. These are examples, and here's a preparation of retina. It's a rat retina which has been cut, a transverse section through the retina. So that means the retinal eye cup is taken and cut, and then we are looking at the cut end so that the cells are going top down. This is towards the brain or the photoreceptor layer here, and this is the vitreous surface, which is the eye cup, the inner surface of the eye cup. And what I have labeled here are the Müller cells, which are type of glial cells, astrocyte-like, which contain GFAP, the normal markers of astrocytes. And then when they are stimulated, they propagate this wave from the end feet region over here in the vitreous layer towards the photoreceptor. Now here's the cell body, so it has these long processes which come up here, expand, and basically line the inner eye cup. So this is a type of a wave that is generated both either by, in this particular case, I have applied, bath-applied ATP, so this purinergic receptor-mediated wave. You could generate also by local electrical stimulation of the retinal slice. The next is a single cell, single astrocyte. This is one of the oldest pictures that I have shown many times, and this is a wave that begins at this pole of the cell and transmits. So it is a very flat astrocyte, at best about 2 microns thick, laying on top of a glass, and we are imaging from the bottom. And this is stimulated by with the norepinephrine, which one application of norepinephrine which persists, and this is repeated waves that going beginning at this pole and going towards the other end. And then of course this propagation pattern breaks down over 5 or 6 oscillations, but the first 3 at least always begin here and propagate towards the other end. We will come to that in a minute.
So the periodicity is not imposed?
No. This is the, there's a global application, like a sewer pipe-like technique of agonist, and which covers the entire field all at once. Of course, if you look at independent cells, they'll oscillate at their own period, but this cell has its period and it oscillates in the presence of the continued presence of the agonist. It's not imposed. Here is another. This is a different type of glial cells. This is oligodendrocyte progenitor cells. These are progenitors for oligodendrocytes, which will later on become cells that will form myelin and cover the axon. And their major function is to in neuroconduction. So these, when stimulated with the ATP, also produce these waves. Here again, the ATP is present continuously, and the oscillations and the waves are generated on their own, with their own period. So we chose this particular glial cell type because of their morphology. As you can see, they could be considered as a long, thin, slender hose pipe, so easy to analyze wave propagation, which is basically where we chose. So here are these cells. Now these are loaded with fluorophore, that is what you're looking at. The beauty of these cells is that they have a cell body and they are bipolar, slender processes. If you look at these, So this is the dimension, and when you look at YZ view end on, the diameter is about 2.5 microns. So it's fairly thin, long. You don't even need confocal microscopy to measure waves in these. So we use this and generated waves stimulated by ATP and analyzed it in this way. This where the, if you imagine the process sitting here, it's been sectioned into 1 micron bins in the entire length, and then placed them with this little bit of an offset, the equal offset along the y-axis, and plotted them. Then you can actually visualize the wave. And immediately one can see that there are number of wave initiation sites where, with one of them taking primary initiation role, the wave always begins here at this particular location in the cell, and then it propagates in both directions. Before this reaches another place here, a small wave begins, and over here and over there. If we repeated this stimulation of the same, well, yeah, this is only to show that those bins came from this long process that is here, which has been now was placed vertically. Now, if you repeat the stimulus twice or many times, the pattern
again, the stimulus is
the agonist, which is present continuously.
And
this is ATP.
In space, it's where?
It's globally applied into the
along here?
Yes. So the sewer pipe basically covers the entire visual field or microscopic field, and the field is about 200 by 200 microns. There may be, as you saw, many cells in that. Every one of them is dunked at once, and then it kept bathed all the time. So then in here, there's a delay of 20 minutes in between. So this is an experience of totally about 30 minutes, two applications, with a 20-minute gap in between to, for the cells to recover. And what one can see is that the pattern is almost exactly identical in the two response patterns. So that means the wave begins in the same location in the process, propagates, and the velocities are approximately the same. There is a little bit of a reduction in amplitude when you measure the individual signals, which is what we did. We analyzed from each of these traces the wave amplitude, the rise time, as well as the time at 50% of the peak, so that we could calculate the wave speeds, and that is plotted here. So what one sees is that number of peaks in the rise times, which appear to be places where a enhanced calcium release takes place as the wave moves along. Similarly, the amplitude kind of reflects that rise time. So suggesting that there is local areas in this process where the calcium release is much faster, much enhanced compared with the other regions in the cell.
Are those amplitudes, those are initiation sites too, that they have the highest amplitude?
The initiation sites, no, not necessarily the highest amplitudes. The initiation sites, well, this plot shows where they are located, at least, because here what we have done is time to 50% peak is plotted against the length again. And so the earliest arrival is here, and there is some here, one here in this process. So in
so down there, they all have the same origin of time.
Yes.
And you're saying how long it takes in the process.
Yes.
Whereas up here, these peaks occur at different times.
Yes, correct. Yes, exactly. Now, as the wave goes, if you look at that little bin of the process, it has much higher amplitude signal as well as much higher rise time, faster rise time. So as if more calcium is coming out per unit time at that. So suggesting the localization of the release machinery is, yes.
Sorry, the rate of rise to peak, so you have several different peaks and you take the greatest peak.
No, it's each one of this, that data came from each one of these traces.
Right.
So that means...
Which peak? He's asking which peak?
Yeah, which peak? Do you pick the biggest peak?
At a given point in space.
Right.
As you go in time, there'll be lots of peaks.
Right.
And he's asking
which peak? The very first one.
The very first
one? Very first one, exactly, yeah. So if it oscillates here, it'll have another peak. Now, it's this first one, first wave that we're looking at.
Doesn't necessarily be the biggest.
Right. No.
Right.
No. So each in each wave, in each location, there's only one peak.
One first peak.
One first peak. That's correct. okay. So that's the wave amplification side, which is since they were invariant for multiple stimulations, this suggested to us that the localization of specialized machinery, much like what we heard yesterday from Ian, that at least during his stimulus time in the Xenopus as well, the release sites were invariant, and that he would be able to measure the calcium sparks in those locations. So our wave amplification sites where the local calcium release kinetics are high, amplitude and the rise time, and the wave speed is faster, hence it is the microdomain of calcium release, which is a specialized response element. One can think of it as a specialized response element, which is what we measured using the line scan technique, which we learned from the cardiac physiologists initially. So this is one oligodendrocyte progenitor process in which we are scanning across. This is an unstimulated process, so this is a spontaneous spark or a puff. We could think of this as what we believe is an IP3 receptor mediated signal, so that means this should be technically called the puff. So it's a spontaneous puff, and there is a mini puff or a mini blip that is over here in this trace. This is very few and far between, so obviously spontaneous release like this occurs in glial cells as well. We saw that one can, Ian measuring this in the Xenopus yesterday. So,
I'm sorry, what are the three?
The three traces are coming from three different locations. This one, I haven't marked that here. This one from about here, this one from about here, and this one in line with that little blip that we see here. So this trace refers to that, this trace refers to this. And this is another example of our puffs measured in oligodendrocyte progenitor process. So here the process is about 20-25 microns laying across like this. Time is running left to right. What you can see are three release sites. You may not believe it the first time, but you can see these repeating about many times, and the middle one, in fact, the third time sparks brightly. The amplitude is high enough to recruit the neighboring two release sites to produce a local wave. So these are puffs initiated by sub-threshold concentrations of agonist in the range of 10 nanomolar or so. And so this particular three-dimensional plot shows this area where you can see the three different release sites, two on either side of the major one which initiated the local wave. So what you can see are sparks, macro sparks, and local waves created by sub-threshold stimulation using agonist. This is a kinetic analysis in space and time. Here, C is a plot of the temporal distribution of this plotted at this space. And this one is a spatial plot of...
Oh, this is C. It says C there.
Oh, this is C. I'm sorry. This is C. This is a spatial plot, and this is a temporal plot taken over here. I can't see without my glasses up there. I'm reading CSD. Sorry.
The amplification sites, I had a Mark?
No, I'm finished. Okay.
Just you remember a few years ago, Leslie Lowe published a sort of model of the geometry of the neurite, and you looked at the IQ3 production, and that in the neurite, because of the geometry, it's a smaller space, IQ3 run faster there than in the cell body.
Yes.
Do you see any initiations, like any little restrictions or something, you know, like that you actually look for, that maybe there's something special about just the geometry and it's not actually...
After Leslie's publication, we did look for, we couldn't see any in the glial cell process, but maybe, you know, these are cells which are attached grown on glass for 3 days at least. So by that time, it's possible that they are all flattened out. Now, we didn't do any volume measurements per se, so it's possible that there are differences. But it is also possible that the IP3 concentration is the same throughout, because you'll see when we measured the receptor distribution, surface membrane receptor distribution, it seems kind of diffuse, mostly. With patches, again, it's not always diffuse, whereas IP3 receptors are patched very much. Patched, I'll show you in a little bit. The initiation sites, on the other hand, we could not differentiate. We couldn't predict beforehand where the initiation sites will be, whereas once the initiation sites were recorded, they remained the same for each cell.
Is the initiation site always one of those release sites?
Yes, there is. When you measure, on either side, you'll see a peak and a valley. But in answer to Jim's question, that was not the highest release site for that process.
Right, but it's always one release.
Yes, correct. So it's as if that some release sites have lower threshold, and there is one which has the lowest threshold, which sets the stage, basically. Okay, so this is just to show, by having a mass measurement, where in fact the center of the release site is the one release site which is repeating twice. Whereas those were IP3 mediated, those are methacholine stimulated calcium waves in oligodendrocyte processes, this is a ryanodine receptor mediated true spark in the OP cell process. So this is using DMPX as a stimulus of the ryanodine receptor. We use DMPX, which is an analog of caffeine, which acts like caffeine as an agonist for ryanodine receptor. It is about fivefold more potent, and that's the main reason that we use it. We have to use at 5 millimolar concentration. Caffeine we would have to use in the range of 25 to 30 millimolar, which we didn't want to. So,
it's a technical thing.
Yeah.
With DMPX, do you get quenching of the dye like you do with caffeine?
No, we didn't. Oh. No, no. Not at this time scale here. See, this is 2 seconds. So 2, 4, 6 seconds, this total experiment here is. And then the recording is done.
Caffeine quench should usually be instant. As soon as you
see, I see. No, we don't see that.
Evaporation of caffeine, but it's instantaneous. Also, with the DMPX, is it an antagonist of IP3 receptors like caffeine?
We haven't checked that. No, we haven't checked that. We have never applied DMPX and looked for methacholine responses. At least Peter may have done that, but I don't remember that data. So this actually is a history going. Time runs here and continues. That's totally, as I said, it's a 6 second history. Just to point out that there's one spark and then it goes quiet. Another site takes over, which after a couple of small sparks produces a wave that can propagate for some time, and later on another site takes over, and then while the same site comes back again over here. So this ryanodine receptor system also functions as mini sparks, blips, and macro sparks, and local waves which can expand into global calcium wave in these processes as well. So this is, okay, so this again, comparison of the DMPX produced calcium sparks in these processes and methacholine produced waves. Now, DMPX here is two examples that I'm showing, again, as single sparks produce local waves and global waves that can propagate. And in this example, you can see a local wave that dies out, but then many small events occur, followed by a big one, which propagates as a wave. This here compares methacholine at IP3 receptor-mediated waves at a large maximal concentration of the agonist and a very low concentration. The very low concentration produces initial sparks, and this is where mostly measurements were made of individual sparks. And this is expanded here, which then later on produces a local wave and a global wave. The high concentration of agonists always produced a very fast global wave immediately. So this is an analysis, a frequency, a histogram of amplitudes and full width at the half max for individual sparks and puffs. And this is full duration at half max, similarly calculated. So looking at the width of the spark and the puff, both.
How do you distinguish between a spark and a puff?
Oh, I'm using the term only when we look at ryanodine receptor produced events as sparks, and that we do by stimulating only the ryanodine receptor. And methacholine, when we stimulate, we assume all of the signal is from IP3 receptor events, and the IP3 receptor mediated events are termed puffs.
But they don't have different kinetic or dynamic or geometrical characteristics.
No, not.
So you could just call them all
sparks.
Puffs.
Spuffs. You're right. Well, well, we actually. Whereas IP3. The DMPX produced events can be blocked with ryanodine, and the methacholine produced events could not be. There was no effect of, and that's the only data. Zestospongin did not have any effect on DMPX produced sparks. So that's the only experiment that we have to say that they in fact are each one stimulating two different. We didn't see that in those, you know, again, we're looking at this, you apply, wait for some time, and then look for 2 seconds. One scan, or maybe two or three. Whether, if one waits long enough, whether there's a cooperation between the two receptors, because they seem to be expressed in the same kind of locations again, is a question that is to be asked experimentally.
What is D? Is that duration?
Yes, that's right, yes. So they are basically, in this analysis, they are more or less the same.
Right.
All of them, yeah. So there's spontaneous events. We have only 9 of them. Only 9 of them in about 60 or so experiments.
The calcium wave following methacholine, how much of a contribution of ryanodine receptors is there to that wave? Probably because there are circumstances where IP3 receptors sort of tickle up CFCR
yes.
through ryanodine
yes.
receptors,
yeah.
and then you get wave initiation.
We don't know how much the contribution is. There is some sort of a crosstalk between the two receptors. Low-level stimulation of methacholine receptors, and which doesn't really produce a wave, sensitizes the ryanodine receptor. This is the only data that we have. What is the quantitative contribution of ranitidine receptors to methacholine-produced waves is, we have no real experiments.
If you have ranitidine present, you haven't been able to measure a difference in amplitude.
No. So, but we do believe that there is some kind of a crosstalk because of the other experiment, the sensitization data that we have. I don't think I had it here. So this is some kind of a pharmacology, is really not clear cut. So there is no effect of ranitidine on methacholine produced. That means there were no cells that didn't produce a spark, that all the cells we measured sparks in were able to produce sparks in the presence of ranitidine when methacholine as a stimulus was applied, whereas 28% of the cells did not respond in the presence of zestospengin or APB. Here, things are a lot more complex. So, ranitidine inhibits, so does zestospengin, so does APB. These are, APB particularly is a notoriously bad drug to be used here, but that's all we have as a, other than zestospengin, as an inhibitor of the IP3 receptor when we don't have ways to inject the cells with heparin, for example.
So the zestospengin C could be depleting the stores as well?
Yes, could. So, yes? This is number of sparks measured during the two scans, which is 4 second period. So you count the number of sparks.
Per two scans,
yes. Yeah.
How many cells do you look at?
Well, here, 16 cells, 5 cells, 14, 12, these are cell numbers that we've looked at. Okay. The last section that I had is looking at, well, the invariant nature of the wave amplification sites or the microdomains would suggest specializations, cellular specializations that are there. And that is what we try to analyze by looking at IP3 receptor distribution and proteins that are involved in calcium signaling, their distribution, and asking whether they are in some way concentrated in these areas, as well as organella specialization, particularly the mitochondria. So I put this as the very first one, because here, when we were measuring calcium spark or SPUF, we looked at, again, this is a fluorophore-filled process of the OP cell, and the same cell stained with the TMRE, which is a mitochondrial membrane potential sensitive dye, which is, we heard from Jim Lechleiter yesterday, the same dye, and which marks for us where the mitochondria are sitting. So they are, in this process, they're fairly sparse. Over long distances, there is, in this particular case, only 3 mitochondria that are sitting. Maybe there are 2 here side by side, but I think this is one of them, which is inhomogeneously stained by TMRE. But if we look at this history of spark for a sub-threshold stimulus with methacholine, one sees that the sparks, in fact, are mainly present only where the mitochondria are. So this has been consistently our finding, that when you look at the length of the process, all of the microdomain specialized calcium release sites also have a mitochondrion present in there. So we hypothesize that maybe mitochondria indeed interact with the calcium release site on the endoplasmic reticulum. We and others, particularly Tullio Poisson's lab and Yuri Hainosky and Andy Thomas, have done a series of experiments to suggest that an intimate interaction between the mitochondria and the endoplasmic reticulum calcium release machinery, in fact, exists. That's still in debate, what is the precise interaction between IP3 receptors and ranitidine receptors and the mitochondrion. But we heard yesterday, again, from Jim, that the change in calcium concentration has profound influence on the mitochondria in terms of ATP production in that local area.
Sorry, you mentioned that it is spark initiation site that is adjacent to the mitochondria. Is it true for the PUF initiation site?
We actually have not looked at it in this way. I don't remember we looked at it in this way. This is a methacholine stimulus. We had not done a similar experiment with DMPX, so I don't have the data. But we believe that the specializations where there is calcium release specialization, that there are mitochondria always associated in this particular cell. To the point we were able to use the localization of the mitochondria as an indicator of where the microdomains might be present in this kind of a lengthened glial cell processes.
Have you ever looked at the cells stimulated by the EMPX and methacholine and see whether the two initiation sites might be in the same place?
The same cell.
Same cell. Yeah. No, we have not done that. That would be an interesting experiment to do. Well, you'll see, I'll show you one distribution data, the IP3 receptor clusters and the ryanodine receptor clusters occur in the same areas under the process. So if you look at along the process, there are beads of the receptor and they call localize. Yeah, you've seen this? I put this after we listened to Jim's talk where we had the discussion of whether the mitochondria are changing and with the calcium signal here in the process. This is measuring calcium, cytoplasmic calcium and mitochondrial membrane potential simultaneously in single mitochondria along this process. So of course the idea is that there is a intimate interaction between calcium that is coming out of the at the mouth of the channel, IP3 receptor channel, and the mitochondrion. So what it shows, what I'm showing here is there's this oscillating signal that is measured in the region around the mitochondrion, and while the calcium goes up, there is an associated depolarization of the membrane potential in that mitochondrion. So this is actually dually labeled cell. This is measured in the same region of interest with two different probes, one mesh TMRE, I think this, yeah, this is TMRE and fluorophore.
Which is the one on the bottom though? It's
actually this one is another mitochondrion, another cell. So you see this as well as this, so meaning here the signal is going the opposite direction as if this mitochondrion doesn't care. Of course, there's a huge increase in calcium. So we've seen both. We had not analyzed that. But this is again is in that small region. So you draw you saw how the mitochondrion distribution is. So you draw one little box around in that area. So in the same region of interest, you measure the two signals. Okay, so that's only an aside. So as I mentioned, we were able to use the distribution of mitochondria as a marker for where the calcium release microdomains might be. And here, this is IP3 receptor distribution in a cultured oligodendrocyte progenitor cell. Cell body is here, and the process is running along over here. And you could see here this one mitochondrion sitting, and the green signal, which is the IP3 receptor distribution, is also present as a patch in that region and another place where a mitochondrion is, another place where the mitochondrion is. And now, this is not an artifact. If you turn the XZ view of this region, also shows clearly an intimate interaction relationship between the ER and the mitochondrion. So the next is we looked at calreticulin. Again, calreticulin is a luminal calcium binding protein. which also is not uniformly distributed in the process, which has specific regions where it is concentrated, and in those regions, mitochondria are also always found. So this is an XZ view of this process that is going up, which is when you turn around, you can see the co-localization fairly clearly. This box shows here.
Those are IP receptors. Do you have any other marker for the ER, just the membranes? So are those voids of ER in between, you know, where there actually just
is? Yes, there is ER. You know, you can actually see, you know, by proxy in this picture. This picture is the mitochondria are stained with DIIOC6, which is a dye which is used for staining, in fact, intracellular membranes, including my endoplasmic reticulum. This is Mark Terasaki's dye, which he developed for staining ER in the CH and egg. So you can actually see this thin veil-like structure is not just dye freely floating, but in fact, dye staining ER. So we believe the ER is continuous, a tubular structure just like in any other cell, and it is present throughout the process. Whereas proteins are patched in this membrane in different places. This is what I'd like to believe, at least. Yeah, this is calreticulin, by the way. Yeah. And this is the circa. And circa also is concentrated now in regions where mitochondria are found. So this is an OP cell, and this is one single astrocyte. So the circa is in green, and mitochondria are in red. So there, again, you find circa co-localization with mitochondria. We believe that will suggest that in the cellular processes, the endoplasmic reticulum has patches of circa which co-localize, which the patches are found where the mitochondria are. Now this is the last example of co-localization I'm going to show. This is, in fact, IP3R2. RYR3 and the co-localization. So in this cell, the only IP3R isoform that is found is the R2, and the RYR isoform is R3. So that also is fairly clean for us to analyze protein distribution and protein dynamics in this particular cell when we can grow them in fairly pure, as pure cultures. So when we look at this little beaded appearance is seen only in the same regions in the same process, so as if they are co-localized. So it kind of would support our interaction between the two receptors, though the data is very, very minimal at this point. Yes?
Have you ever over-transfected these cells with the ER-targeted GFP, for instance?
No, not yet.
This is all fit specimens, and one could envisage,
yes,
during the fixation process that all the structures would look,
yes,
where maybe the mitochondria
are, well,
on the same site.
Peter, in fact, did one experiment, a series of experiments actually, where we measured the calcium wave, we analyzed the microdomains, and post hoc fixed the cell and went and looked at where the receptors and mitochondria are. And that was our really earliest indication that these specializations do exist. So unless, of course, because they corresponded with our amplification sites, which we plotted in the kind of plot that I showed you earlier on. So it's possible, but I don't think it's really the reason why we are seeing it this way. Why in these cells the spots occur in that particular place may be substrate dependent, because they are growing on the glass, whereas when you look at the brain, things may be very, very different. I think I have one more picture. This, in fact, is a section. And I just show only IP3R and a cell marker. This is, in fact, this is a marker for an oligodendrocyte. So it's in the white matter, so this is one one kind of axon bundle that is running. And you can see even there you have these patches. These patches occur in discrete locations. And what we think is that these are sitting in glial cells at strategic locations where the interactions between axon and the oligodendrocytes occur. Because it's a section through the brain, we can't tell whether these are nodes of Ranvier. We would like to think that nodes of Ranvier is where the interaction between the glial cell and the axon are, in fact. So much for localizations. I think I'm going to conclude very soon, unless there are questions. The microdomains contain high-density patch of IP3Rs and high-density of circa pumps, as well as high concentration of luminal chiral reticulin. And these are ones that I list here that we have data for. They are juxtaposed to mitochondria and found 5 to 7 microns apart. So this 5 to 7 micron measurement comes from a calculation of where the peaks in calcium release occur, as well as where the sparks occur in distances, defined distances along a process. So that's where that analysis.
Did you ever try to say do protein ionophore at TCP to see if that actually messed up your initiation sites?
You mean do the ionophore and then post hoc stimulate again?
Yeah.
No. No. That should be interesting to see. Or we can clamp at different concentrations and see also. The conclusions then are multiple cellular specializations are associated with microdomains of calcium release. Elementary calcium release events could be recorded at these particular sites, and calcium sparks are elicited by stimulation with both agonists for ryanodine receptors as well as IP3 receptors. The two receptor types are expressed in similar locations and probably are poised to interact with each other, and that is still an unresolved question in my mind. More experiments need to be done. So I drew this cartoon thinking of disorganization consisting of multiple proteins. They're not where the cell positions these proteins where it wants to, in such a way this whole organization is maintained by means of chaperones and scaffolding proteins, such that an interaction with the cytoskeleton that exists here. So you have the surface membrane, the mitochondrion, and the endoplasmic reticulum membrane all having specific proteins, but they interact with each other either directly or through scaffolding proteins which bring them and keep them in place. Now, we had long discussions yesterday about how such an organization might be in fact dynamic, but that means proteins here on this membrane moving away and reappearing, and how that is controlled, of course, will be an interesting question to study.
Do you have evidence that Homer actually is tagging
the actors? This is not my evidence. This is many people who have immunoprecipitated with TRP channel as well as IP3 receptor channel have brought down Homer together with this. That's the data. That's the reason I'm plotting this.
Is that just sort of in the background?
Oh, it's in the background, yes. I'm not linking the mitochondria with Homer, no. No. But some people think there is a variant of TRP channel is sitting in the mitochondrion, and you mentioned yesterday that also data from ryanodine receptor-like protein in the mitochondrion. So, yeah, well, this is kind of a model that I have drawn with data from our lab and other people's findings, including Shmuel Mualim and the Baltimore group, works on Homer. I meant for it all to come at the same time. The functional significance of these, we have heard since yesterday and today, the locally discrete signaling which cells require for their cell biological processes, particularly in the nervous system. Wave propagation, again, nervous system is one example where waves are propagated over long distances in order for information processing, but the specific how glial cell waves participate in information processing is not known at the moment. Intercellular communication, we'll hear again much more about this afternoon. What I'm thinking of is that cells might place this specialized calcium release sites at locations where they have to interact with the neighboring cell for specific connectivity purposes. I end with a list of people who have worked on this subject for a long time, starting with Sergei. And Lynn Holskla is a senior research assistant in the lab who's been with me for a long time. Peter Simpson, these are key people who I'm mentioning, who Peter worked with me for about 3 years, who's now at Merck. And the current people are Susanna Wiert and Joanna Toos, who's in the lab continuing. Thank you very much. A major collaboration from Greg Minery, Heping Chen, Alan Sharp and Isaac Pessa, who gave us antibodies and other reagents, particularly for IP3 receptor and ranitidine receptor. Thank you very much. We don't have an estimate such as that in the glial cell.
It's my impression that your main thesis that you need these microdomains and they're the cause of the puffs or sparks or whatever is sort of the opposite of a point of view that is in contradiction to what Martin was talking about yesterday in his interpretation of the puffs and waves in Ian's experiment, because if I understood correctly, in Martin's point of view, what you have is a system which is excitable and essentially unstable, or close to instability, and it's just waiting for the initiation of these excitations, and any infinitesimal local advantage. See, your sites are basically places of some finite concentration of something which will excite the wave. But I believe that in the model that Martin talked about, any infinitesimal local advantage will, as things fluctuate, eventually produce the spark. And the fact that it's repeatable, it just means that it's a quenched, it's there once and for all for a given cell, infinitesimal local advantage. The analogy is, you think of a marathon, and the winner is some real, or the Tour de France, and Lance Armstrong is just real special. But every race has a winner, no matter how bad the runners are. And if the local advantage is repeatable, then it'll always be the same winner. And you say to yourself, well, that must be some kind of Lance Armstrong. No, it isn't. It's just the others are even worse. And I think, and he could be only infinitesimally better than the others. And he'd consistently win. And you'd say, well, this is some kind of huge champion. And so I wonder if one could try to, I mean, that's a kind of a qualitative difference. Is this special machinery necessary? It may be there. I mean, you have evidence that it is there. But it is there. Is it there always? And is it necessary in order to get the phenomena you're talking about? And if I'm not mistaken, in Martin's model, which is sort of a version of the general model, that's not necessary.
Really, there was a slide here where you could see, depending on the level of stimulation, lower the events.
I'll go back there. We'll keep talking.
Yeah, so there was a slide where you could see local events at low stimulation and then waves at a larger stimulation. Yeah. This one here.
Yeah, comparing this to that.
Yeah.
The larger stimulation and the lower stimulation.
So I think here's a similar transition. At low stimulation, you get local events. Yeah, and at stronger stimulation, you get global events.
Yes.
And what I showed you yesterday in simulations and what comes out of Ian Parker's experiments is it's very similar. So at low stimulation, at low IP3 concentrations, you just get local events. And if you increase the stimulation, you get global events with decreasing average temporal distance.
The question is, what quenched structure do you need?
Hmm.
What is the system that you need in order to get this behavior from different kinds of stimulation? And the question is, do you need a heterogeneity which is where there are order one differences between different points, or can it be just something random with infinitesimal differences, quenched? So in time they persist, but they're infinitesimal. Here, the model that you're espousing is that there are these places and where there's a real sort of champion that's going to be that much more stimulating than everybody else. And the question is whether this behavior is a sign of such order one differences, or if it would arise from the complicated dynamics with randomness, quenched randomness, which could be very small difference. That's the question.
In simulations, you can get the same behavior in a completely regular array.
Mm.
You can build up...
With some randomness.
You use an array with regular spacing, so the clusters are spaced exactly all the same, and they all have the same number of channels.
No, he gets repeatable localization.
Yeah, let me finish. So and then you will see the same transition from just local events,
yes,
to global events. Yeah. The only difference is that the transition range in parameter space is much smaller. So the you will get this transition from local to global events in a very small parameter range. So the for the phenomenon in principle, the distinguished sites are not needed.
No, but he does see distinguished sites, and the question is, what is that evidence of? I've said it three times, so.
For me also, overall, I agree with Martin in the sense that the two systems behave very similarly. The only difference is that maybe perhaps because the morphology of this structure is so different and its functions are very different from that of a huge basketball-sized Xenopus oocyte, in such a way that it requires, it gives special properties to a particular location. Perhaps it is morphologically determined, and that will, so they, IP3 concentration, if it somehow is subtly different in one region, that'll change that particular microdomain to fire with a much lower threshold, perhaps.
Okay, actually just a very basic question, how you envisage the distribution of IP3 receptors release sites along the process, and are you thinking that the only place there are release channels is at discrete sites, maybe just three or four along your scan line, and you simply can't get calcium release in the middle? Is it just passive diffusion fills in the gap? Or are there many release sites and some are more favored than others?
At this kind of a scale, so you have about 25 microns here, I think there may be receptors here in between these three, but either they're not releasing or that for the way we are measuring the signal, these are the only three places that we can measure sparks, even the mini sparks that we see. So propagation from here to here, in fact, is diffusion, is the way I'm thinking. So in here, these three sites keep firing, but at random it seems, because here it's missing, this one is missing over here and fires here, whereas this one fires only twice and this one fires four times, whereas this one fires at this particular spark, was able to create, produce a wave. So this again, we can think of this as somehow it took supremacy for some reason. Yeah, we did. In one of the traces, the velocities in fact change depending on the cluster distances. So it's become, there's a regions of the cell, the velocity is much slower than other region or cell or process.
Back to, what Jim was saying before about Leslie Lowe's model, whereby decreased volume increases the likelihood of, well, you have a higher local concentration of IP3, which this would also be the case if you had mitochondria in those regions where you displace cytosol. So you would, in effect, have a higher concentration of local IP3 in those regions.
It could, yes, yes.
So, that might fit.
Yes.
You imply that the sites might be implicated in wave propagation. In terms of signal propagation from one part of the extension to another part. Have you done an experiment that could actually show that you only stimulate locally and you actually see a wave going through in the sense, I mean,
yes.
Here you stimulate globally, so there's no real information transfer in the...
Yes, we have. We have done. We've not been able to do with very discrete small regions about in the range of 1 or 2 microns, but we have used a pipette to a flow pipette to puff on, and then also of course there the wave, we're forcing the microdomains in that region to fire, and that's where the wave begins and propagates in both directions.
So this wave will propagate through the whole.
Yes, depending on the stimulus. Intensity, it goes more or less longer distances.
The global stimulation is not a prerequisite?
No, to produce a wave, yeah, no. Yeah. Yes.
So when I think inside one of these cells, in these clusters, can I think of them as relay stations, like in a home network where I have somebody who sends another one who receives, and I go from one to the next to the next?
Yes, you could think of them that way. Yes, you could think of them that way, or something similar to the nodes of Ranvier. So you really have a saltatory propagation. And it's not maybe as regular as the nodes of Ranvier in the nerve, in the axon.
I'm interested in...
You mentioned that you have a, you can have wave propagation with a local stimulus. What is the stimulus? Is that the ryanodine stimulation or the IP3 receptor stimulation? Because I can imagine ryanodine generated wave being propagated through the CICR through the ryanodine, but if you're just stimulating the IP3 receptor, there's no CICR. You have to generate some.
We generate IP3. We have not. We released IP3. We've used agonists, puffed on agonists. So
right.
That means
what,
it is IP3.
What agonist? What kind of agonist is that? The agonist for the ryanodine? That will stimulate the ryanodine mechanism, or the agonist that will stimulate the
so
IP3?
So we used the agonist to the surface membrane receptor, which is methacholine, which will produce IP3 inside. So not ryanodine. We have not tried DMPX. In our cell type, it's very difficult to stimulate the ryanodine receptor.
But in that case, the propagation of the calcium wave through just the IP3 receptor mechanism, you need some IP3 along the way. Because
so this is why I said, depending on the stimulus intensity, the wave goes more or less distance. And I think the IP3 amount of IP3 produced is proportional to our stimulus intensity. Agonist concentration. It's much more controllable if you could spatially photorelease, for example, known amounts of IP3.
So are there any more questions? If not, then we will go on at 10:30 and we'll have a coffee break now for 20 minutes.